Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. On Monday, Bob Dylan will turn 80 years old. And throughout the weekend, music critics, musicians, historians, superfans, archivists, and other researchers will touch on virtually every aspect of Dylan's life and musical output in a virtual symposium titled Dylan at 80, hosted by the Institute of Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa. This comes at the same time as a new book of essays that examines all of his different musical pathways, his influences, and the myriad ways his music and lyrics have influenced others. The World of Bob Dylan features over 20 contributors in a series of essays. Both were put together by my guest today, Professor Sean Latham, who is the director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa and editor of The World of Bob Dylan, published by Cambridge University Press. Latham is also featured in a series of radio podcasts this month for BBC Radio 4, It Ain't Me You're Looking For, Bob Dylan at 80. That's available at bbc.co.uk. And he joins me today to share a little about the book and the symposium, which gets underway virtually this Saturday. Information on attending is at dylan.utulsa.edu. Sean Latham is my guest today. Sean Latham, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Of course. It's a great pleasure to be here.
This has been a busy time for you as the director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies, as Bob Dylan is turning 80 years old next Monday, May 24th, and you have a symposium and a new book about Bob Dylan coming out, and obviously one of the most important singer-songwriters of the past 60 years. What's the starting point for assessing that legacy in both your book and the symposium?
You know, I think for me, I feel really fortunate. As you know, I came to Tulsa 20 years ago to study James Joyce because Tulsa also happens to be the home of James Joyce studies. And Joyce is arguably, I think, inarguably really, the most influential artistic figure of the early part of the 20th century. And I feel extremely lucky that Tulsa now has the papers, the life archive of the most important artist from the second half of the 20th century. Because the thing about Dylan is he's not just a singer-songwriter. He's an activist, and his work has affected politics. It's affected visual art. It's affected film. It's affected literature. When he won the Nobel Prize, there was a little bit of debate, of course, about whether or not he deserved it. But other Nobel laureates like Katsuo Ishiguro and Salman Rushdie both said, "We're so glad Dylan got this. He changed the way we understood language. He changed the way we thought words could be used and what you could do with art." So, you know, for me, we can go back to that earliest Dylan, those first songs that he writes, and you see the seeds there of a guy that's going to go on to basically become a fundamental part of world history.
Do you look at him through the words that he wrote for the songs or the songs themselves?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, Dylan himself was incredibly ambivalent when he accepted the Nobel Prize. You may recall that it took him 2 weeks to actually answer the invitation, and this was unprecedented. People had turned down the Nobel Prize before, but no one had just ignored the committee. And they tried very hard to get in touch with him. And I think it's somewhat humbly, he did eventually accept the prize and said, "I'm ambivalent because I don't know if I'm really a writer of literature. I'm a performer. My work lives," he said, "in performance, not on the page." So that was his ambivalence about accepting it. And for a literary scholar like me, of course, Dylan's words really seem to resonate and matter. But for Dylan, he says, you know, the things that are important is that you can inhabit this music. Other people can find different kinds of things in those words. They can get up on the stage and do different kinds of things with it. And you see this in a song like Blown in the Wind, one of Dylan's most famous, where it was a civil rights anthem in the 1960s, but Regina Spektor just played it a couple of years ago at the Women's March. I think she was in L.A. The march, of course, was in Washington, and it was still a vivid and powerful protest song then. And as I've said to others, you know, there are lots of things you can do with James Joyce, but you can't really cover Joyce's Ulysses. But man, you can cover Bob Dylan songs, and so many other artists have found things in them that I don't think Dylan knew were there. And that's what makes that art so remarkable to me.
You know, but pinning him down is almost impossible. Even his own stories have changed over the years. In fact, when people are trying to sort of assess him and understand him, he's changing the story, changing the storyline. For a scholar, that's got to be difficult.
Well, it certainly makes me glad I'm not Dylan's biographer, I'll say that. not surprisingly, Dylan is a private guy. He wants to keep parts of his private life private.
And in fact, people go through his trash.
Yeah.
That sort of could make you private.
You know, I mean, in the 1960s, he famously had a motorcycle accident, retreated to Woodstock, New York, and was isolated there for a little while and sort of was trying to recover from the madness of his initial fame. And people were literally sort of breaking into his house. he'd come home and find them swimming in his swimming pool. He records the most terrifying event, which was when he and his wife and a young child came home, and there were people sleeping in his bed, waiting to talk to him about the lyrics of his song. So, of course, you're going to be a private and protective guy after that. And even then, after that, he moved to New York, and that's where this famous guy, A.J. Weberman, the first Dylanologist, started digging through Dylan's trash just to find prescriptions or anything they'd thrown out. This would reveal the secrets of the song. So, yeah, Dylan's elusive, but he needs a private life, too. That's fair.
Yeah. When scholars get together, though, to look at a subject, one of the purposes is to define that subject for, you know, what that person is, how they got to be who they are, their influences, who they in turn influence, and how does that stream go downstream from them, and the scope of that influence. That seems pretty impossible with a subject like Bob Dylan, because you could go music one way, you could go poetry another, you could go political influence, social influence, just about every facet of contemporary life, he's had an influence. How do you attempt to do that?
Yeah, I think that's why I have a book with 27 chapters edited by different authors, is because I don't think there's one Bob Dylan for us to get at. And to be fair, I'm not sure there's one Sean Latham or Rich Fisher to get at. We all live multiple and complex lives. And one of the things that makes Dylan interesting, in part, is that he's willing to make a space for all of those voices within himself. So, that in terms of what scholars can do, that's what they can do. So this book has political philosophers talking about Dylan's ideas of justice. It's got marketing experts talking about the Dylan brand. It's got experts in country music and experts in the civil rights movement, musicologists, literary professors. It's all coming together to say, Dylan looks like this from one direction, but he looks like this if you look at him from a different direction. And so we want that kind of prismatic or fractal view of Dylan in a book like this.
And this book that you've edited, The World of Bob Dylan, do you get diametrically opposed viewpoints?
No, I don't think you get contradictions here, because they do sort of pull together to make this thing called Dylan. And part of what makes Dylan so interesting in that sense is it's not just that he's got many different selves, but Dylan himself is a fascinating researcher of American popular music. He loves all of it. There's nothing that Dylan doesn't seem to love or want to listen to and thus incorporate into his own music. There's folk, there's gospel, there's rock. There's the crooning albums that he released just a few years ago from, with Bing Crosby covers of all things, when his voice is broken and battered and he's trying to be Bing Crosby. There's old country tunes, new kinds of country music. It all comes together for him because he
just... blues.
Yeah, right. I mean, he wants to see, he loves all that stuff. And that's why there are so many Dylans, is he sort of gets fascinated by different genres, I think, and dives into them for a while.
I'm trying to think of another artist of the 20th century. There's only a few that I can think of that sort of has this sort of changing quality. Picasso is one in visual art.
Yeah.
You can look at a Picasso from 1900 and you would not recognize it as the same artist, except we know it's Picasso in 1950 or 1960. Miles Davis is the same sort of thing in jazz. And then Bob Dylan, I can't think of any other artist that you can look at an early work and find them unrecognizable 20, 30 years later.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's why I say Dylan is so important to me as a 20th century, a later 20th century artist, because I think he belongs there with exactly the people you mentioned, Picasso and Miles Davis. And like them, we can pick out their periods where we can say, this is when they did this thing. And then a whole other thing emerges. And it's to Dylan's great credit. I mean, he famously said at one point, I won't have the quote exactly right, but basically, I don't want to be Fat Elvis, by which he means, I don't want to go to Las Vegas. I don't want to have my name on a casino and play the same songs in the same way for the same
age. Never
going
to go to Branson.
Right. No, that is definitely not on Dylan's agenda. And so what he did was just keep finding new stuff. I mean, right down to, as I said, these crooner albums. And I'll say this too, one of the interesting projects Dylan did in the maybe 10 years ago now was called Theme Time Radio Hour, where he decided he wanted to be a radio DJ. And he made this fake radio broadcast that was on Sirius for about 2 years. And he did. He was a radio DJ. And he'd play about an hour's worth of music every night, usually organized around a theme like mom or baseball or smoking. And it is one of the most astonishing lessons in the history of popular music that you can get. You should just listen to all of them and you'll understand how all these things might fit together and flow into one another. And you have Dylan there is kind of a jokester, but also a really good teacher that shows you why the blues intersect with country music, intersect with gospel, and have something to do with Bing Crosby, too.
What do you learn about Dylan from that curation? Because it sounds like a curation.
I think what you learn is, and this is evident from the work I've done in the archive too, is Dylan is a researcher. He's an historian all his own. These songs don't come like Athena out of his head. He spends lots of time listening to lots of stuff. It's all in there. We've always known he was a talented mimic as a young kid. He gets one of those people that just had this extraordinary ability. He could hear a song on the radio or on a record, pick up a guitar and play it, often in the style that he'd just heard. And I think you get that. This is a guy, when he hears a song, it just starts to live inside of him. And he's now this living catalog of thousands, tens of thousands of these songs. I just saw somebody who played guitar with him, Larry Campbell, I think, just put a little piece out saying he was amazed when he would play with Dylan because Dylan didn't usually keep the lyrics on stage with him. He just kept his own massive catalog of lyrics in his head, and he could just come out with them. It's an amazing talent that all lives inside of you like that.
My guest today is Sean Latham. He's the director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa, among other hats he wears at this university. And he's the editor of the new book, The World of Bob Dylan, which is published by Cambridge University Press, featuring scholars from around the world trying to define Bob Dylan on his 80th birthday. And the TU Institute for Bob Dylan Studies is also presenting Dylan at 80, a virtual symposium this Saturday through Monday, featuring a wide array of scholars. Very recognizable names, some not so recognizable, but all Dylan scholars in their own unique way, coming together virtually for this symposium. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is, you know, when you think of Bob Dylan, just first off, you think of, you know, the folk song, the folk influence songs of, you know, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, Blowing in the Wind, Times They Are Changing, and those sorts of things. We have to realize that was 3 years,
mm-hmm.
3 to 4 years of his career. And then it was like something completely different.
And especially when you look at those 60s moments. I mean, Dylan moves to New York in January 1961 to start his career. Within less than a year, he's got his first album. And within basically 3 years, he records songs that transform the folk movement and make it into this national phenomenon, right? Blowing in the Wind. Dylan doesn't get famous with that song. Pierre, Paul, and Mary cover it. And it becomes a chart-topping song, makes the folk movement into the folk boom. And almost as soon as Dylan reaches the sort of height of the folk movement within that very short 3-year window, he's on to making rock music. And he makes the most astonishing trio of rock albums, basically between 65 and 66. Within about a period of 14 months, he makes maybe the 3 most influential rock albums that have ever been made. And then has a motorcycle accident, retires to Woodstock for a while, and comes out best friends with Johnny Cash recording country songs in Nashville. It's an extraordinary ability to just shift so completely away. The whole world wants Dylan in 1968 to be a rock star. I mean, they put Woodstock in Woodstock, New York, in part because they hoped Dylan would come. Dylan went to the Isle of Man. He wanted no part of that. He'd already moved on to something else. People couldn't believe it when you get an album like Nashville Skyline show up where Dylan's crooning away like Hank Snow or something like that and showing up on Johnny Cash's TV show.
All he's missing is a nudie suit. But that break with the folk music scene is so, it's not just that he moves on. He almost is defiant in that moving on. You know, the Newport Folk Festival where he electrifies and of course the famous tour to Great Britain where, I mean, it was almost like verbal combat with his fans who wanted this old Dylan, not this new Dylan.
Yeah, I mean, not even almost, right? Like, it was literally a battle night to night. And the members of the band that he was playing with on that British tour in 1966, the sets at that point were broken in half. Dylan would play the acoustic guitar and play his folk songs in the first half. Then there'd be a break, and what would become the band would come on stage. Fans would start clapping, booing, and because it's England, they whistle, which is their show of derision, right? So, and they did everything they did to shut it down. And, you know, famously at one concert, somebody yelled Judas at him from the stands. You know, Dylan said, "I don't believe you, you're a liar." And the band themselves recalled how bizarre this whole experience was. These people had bought tickets, like they'd paid money to come to this concert, and they did everything they possibly could to try to shut it down while Dylan and his band just played over the top of all of this hatred. It's like something out of a Greek myth almost, right? And it even makes him different. We were talking about Picasso earlier. Picasso didn't paint paintings and then stand there and say, you know, "I'm going to stand in front of it and have you come and tell me what you really think."
Yeah, but throw tomatoes.
Yeah, Dylan on stage, he did. He stood there and said, "I can take it," you know?
Well, earlier we were talking about the honing of craft in his lyrics and honing the songs. And we are also talking about the garbageologists who are going through Dylan's garbage to try to understand him. One of the things you've had the privilege of doing is going through the archives and seeing the ephemera that helps you understand better Dylan. Can you tell us a little bit about what the archive shows about Dylan's craft?
Yeah. I've been fortunate. I mean, the archive itself is vast. It's 100,000 objects, give or take. The catalog entries for it are much bigger than that because there are stems for every single recording, for example. And I focused a lot of my efforts in particular on a set of notebooks that Dylan kept in Woodstock between about 1966 and 1969. They're tiny spiral-bound notebooks, the kind you'd slide in your back pocket or a guitar case. And they're amazing as you read through them, both because they contain all kinds of touches of everyday life, measurements for curtains and reminders to go to the grocery store. One of my favorite is a little to-do list that says, has several items checked off, and then an entry that says, renew driver's license, and it's not checked off, which I guess meant Dylan was driving around Woodstock with an expired driver's license. But what you then see on those notebooks is that Dylan is reading and listening and trying out on page after page. He's trying out 4 lines, 8 lines. He writes a whole song, abandons it, comes back to a little piece of it later. There are the kernels, at least, of maybe 1,000 songs in these notebooks, far more than we ever thought were being created at this time. And some of them are amazing. I mean, I just did a BBC study of Dylan, and I was able to talk about on there one of the amazing things I found in the notebooks is Dylan's attempt to write a song about the murderer Richard Speck, whose trial was going on in 1966. Guy had murdered 9 nurses. And Dylan clearly thought, is this a little like Pretty Boy Floyd, like what Woody Guthrie did for Pretty Boy Floyd? Could I do something similar? And he tries to write a murder ballad about a terrible person. and it's a really gripping, powerful song, I think, that's all about anger. It's called Nasty Young Man. To his credit, he doesn't actually release or record the song. But it shows, I mean, that gives you just a glimpse, I think, of some of the stuff that Dylan was going on in his mind. He read that article in the newspaper. He thought, is this an outlaw of the modern day? Is this what they look like? Can I make a song about that? How do I do it? Oh, I shouldn't make this song, even though I can kind of identify with them a little bit, the anger, the fury, right, the sense of a society that's on the edge of things. So, I mean, that's just a taste, I think, of that's like one page of the notebooks, right, that are 100,000 things that are in there.
Now, that time that you've been focusing on is also the time of the bootleg recordings, right?
Yeah.
He's just sitting in a basement gathering folks together. Sometimes it's old songs from prison farms. And tell us a little bit about
it. Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's such an amazing moment in American history because in 1968, as Dylan is gathering together that same group that had toured with him in 1966, he had them move up to Woodstock with him. And initially, they just got together and kind of jammed in the afternoons. Dylan had no intention of making an album. And then they turned on a tape recorder and started recording a little bit. So the recordings are never very good. And Dylan starts writing some songs and playing along with the band. And you got to remember, like, at this moment in 1968, everybody's still trying to do what Dylan did in 1966. Like, they're trying to take all of those rock lyrics and that rock sound and Dylan's sort of mod body and make it into that 1968, you know, drug-induced sort of psychedelic rock. And Dylan's out there with acoustic guitars in a basement in the mountains making old country music, essentially. And in doing so, I mean, he explores what the music critic Greil Marcus famously called old weird America, that he dug deep into the history of American music to say we can pull something more out of this. And everyone was astonished when those bootleg recordings from these sessions came out. I mean, the Beatles are doing Sgt. Pepper and Dylan is doing, you know, This Wheel's on Fire. I mean, it's just completely different kind of music and it totally changes everything when those bootlegs begin to leak.
He's really drilling deep into the sort of the heart of Americana, what we call Americana music today.
Americana is invented in that basement. Everybody then wanted that. And still people love that idea of like, I'm going to record with my band in the kitchen or the basement. Like they all want to go back and make their own basement tape because Dylan did it completely different. Nobody thought you could record that kind of stuff in your own house at the time.
Of course, the many different Dylans, you've alluded to a few, you know, the folk Dylan, the rock Dylan, the sort of blues revival Dylan. You got the Nashville Dylan, which is really strange because at the time, you know, Nashville was just the reactionary heart of America. This was the place where, you know, we got to be in Vietnam. You know, just that there's that whole emphasis of this was established. It was becoming establishment music.
Yeah. But also that this is also Nashville at that moment when outlaw country was just taking root, right? So, I mean, that's there's true. A reason Dylan and Johnny Cash became close
Johnny
friends.
Cash is the outlier there, you know, because, yes, in one sense, the establishment could relate to him, but if you actually listen to him, he's subversive.
And they could strike up a friendship in part because when Dylan went to Nashville and hung out with Cash, there's a great recording of them playing old Carter Family songs, so Johnny Cash's in-laws, on the piano in a Nashville recording studio. And here's this Jewish kid from Hibbing, Minnesota, who's still the kind of face of rock star America. And he's telling Johnny, like, I get it. I can do Carter Family tunes right here with you. And they formed a fast friendship then that never broke throughout the rest of Johnny Cash's life.
My guest today is Sean Latham. He is the director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa. He's the editor of the new book, The World of Bob Dylan, published by Cambridge University Press, featuring scholars assessing Bob Dylan's life at this point as Dylan turns 80. And the Institute will be presenting a virtual symposium this weekend, Saturday through Monday, which is Bob Dylan's 80th birthday, titled Dylan at 80. Well, let's talk a little bit about this symposium. Sure. You have people ranging from Greil Marcus to singer-songwriter Rodney Crowell, Sean Wilentz, great historian, Dylan's photographer, Duncan Hume. I'm just naming a few of the people.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about this symposium. What are you going to do in these
days? We did our first one of these in 2019. It was called The World of Bob Dylan back then. And we thought we might be able to get maybe 200 people that would come to Tulsa and talk about Bob Dylan in a kind of serious way, scholars mostly. We had to close registration 2 months early because we had 500 people sign up. And there was an even mix right down the middle of people with academic affiliations and without academic affiliations. And they were all talking to each other. There are different kinds of expertise in the room. And this conference is doing the same thing. So we do have academics here. But as you said, we just recorded the interview with Rodney Crowell. And to listen to that guy talk about why Dylan is the master songwriter and everything Rodney Crowell learned, another Nashville guy, like about how to make music by listening to Dylan albums over and over and over again. It's an amazing. And like you can listen in the interview, Crowell can just rattle off entire songs from Dylan's catalog right off the top of his head. Like he just knows how they work. He talks about how they rhyme, how it taught him to make a certain kind of rhyme. So we'll get that. As you said, we have Sean Wilentz, who's the very distinguished American historian at Princeton, who's got a talk he's going to give about Dylan as an historian. Like, what kind of historian is Dylan? How does he practice the art of history? And we have all kinds of other stuff as well. We have people coming from around the world to talk about various aspects of Dylan fandom and Dylan music. I'm particularly excited about one session we've got that features Dylan collectors.
Right.
So it's a group of people that before there was a Dylan archive, there were these guys, right? And they have obsessively collected every tapes from every concert Dylan's ever given, every ticket stub that they were able to get their hands on, posters, magazines. They were the original archivists, and they're going to be there to each talk about one item that they're particularly excited about from their collections. And
Antiques Roadshow.
Right, yes. And, you know, collectors don't like to share this stuff. So it's going to be a real interesting one-upsmanship as they each try to show off the coolest thing that they think they have in their collection. So that, you know, that's what I mean about bringing together academics like me, but people who have other kinds of expertise and have been doing the Dylan thing for a lot longer than people like me cared about.
And there will also be dives into the archive itself from archivists here working in Tulsa too.
Yeah, we've got the archivists for the Dylan archive there. We've got other scholars from around the world who, like me, have done work in the archive, including my graduate student, Nathan Blue, who's working on, I think, one of my favorite things in the whole archive, which is an unopened bag of fan mail from 1966. A giant U.S. mail bag. I think it has 1,500 letters in it or something like that. Dylan never opened them. So they're time capsules. Each of them, you open this, like you can smell 1966, like come out of them and see how people were reacting to Dylan. What did they write to him? What did they say to him? One of the big surprises in there we found so far is the number of people that sent Dylan songs that they wanted him to perform. Like in some sense, he was teaching them to be poets, right? That he was teaching them to be songwriters. And they felt strongly enough about it that they're like, you helped me make this. Will you perform it? I can't imagine like writing to Garth Brooks and being like, Garth, I wrote this song. Next time you go on stage, will you perform it? But people felt they had this relationship with Dylan.
Well, it was also the 60s too, you know. Another interesting session is you're going to be talking to archivists from other collections, like Springsteen and some other archives.
Yeah, we've got Springsteen in there. So we've got the Springsteen archive, which is taking shape, not surprisingly, in New Jersey. The Grateful Dead archive, which was really one of the first of these archives from that era of music to really begin to take shape in Santa Cruz. And we've got the Leonard Cohen archive, which is going to be shortly coming online. We've got a guy that's talking about working around. There's no formal Beatles archive, but a guy named Ken Womack has written a number of books about the Beatles. We'll be talking about where their stuff is and how it might come together in an archive, because we want to see how does Dylan's stuff line up with what other artists may or may not have saved. I mean, I think writers of fiction, you know, they write always with an eye on the future. So they're going to save their stuff. The Dylan archive, by and large, starts in 1966 because that's when he was in Woodstock and settled down and some enterprising assistant started saving his trash. But before that, he was sleeping on people's couches. There's not a lot of stuff from that period. So it's, I don't think rock stars or musicians at the time thought I should be saving all my things because someday I'll be famous. So Dylan's going to be kind of rare. I think the Grateful Dead are a little bit like this too, in that we just happen to have the stuff. It happens to have survived. By a miracle, it survived. And that way we can peer into the workshop of Daedalus with Dylan in a way we might never be able to with other musicians who didn't think when they were young and up-and-coming songwriters, I should save my rough drafts. I shouldn't throw those notebooks away, right, when I go sleep on my friend's couch or whatever it might be.
Right. I mean, that's the, you know, I think a lot of times people just say, this is ephemeral, you know, yeah. It's just going to clutter up.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, sometimes people save things.
Yeah. And it's amazing when they do. I mean, it's one of the reasons I could, you know, one of the parallels I can draw with Joyce is one of the reasons Joyce has become so interesting as a topic for academics is because in some ways by accident, even though he moved house constantly, he saved all of his journals. And so we too can see how Ulysses took shape from a note that he took on basically the equivalent of a sticky note from the day. And we can trace those words through iteration after iteration after iteration onto the published page of Ulysses. You can now do the same stuff in the Dylan archive by saying, oh, Dylan wrote that down in a notebook in 66 and it shows up in a song in 2003, you know.
Now, of course, the other big announcement earlier this month is there will be an opening date for the archive. What do you think that will do for the scholars and people just interested in Bob Dylan being able to at least see some fraction of this massive collection?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always exciting to see stuff. We're lucky if we're here in Tulsa, we can see it in the Woody Guthrie archives already. We're going to be able to see it at OK Pop. I'm really excited about what's happening down there in Tulsa, that when you kind of stand on that corner there on the edge of Guthrie Green, there's the Woody Guthrie archive. There's going to be the Bob Dylan archives two doors down. Keynes is just up the street there, which is its own kind of musical museum, I think. OK Pop across the street from that. Greenwood and Pine is just down the road. Church Studios is reopening here. I drive by it on my way to work every day. This, I think, thanks in part, not exclusively, but thanks in large part to the Dylan Archives. Tulsa is getting put on the map really rapidly as a place where music is made and studied. And that's really exciting for the city. And I think people are going to come here. I can tell you, because they came to that 2019 conference for just a couple days, just to say a few words about Dylan, people are going to come from all over the world to see Bob Dylan next to Woody Guthrie, next to OK Pop.
Now, is there still room for people to register for the virtual symposium, or is it sold out?
No, it's virtual, so we have an infinite number of seats in the auditorium for you. So it does start on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, so if you want to register, you'll probably want to do so before then, and you can do that at dylan.utulsa.edu, and we'd love to have you if you're interested.
All right. Sean, thanks very much for joining us.
Of course. It's a pleasure.
Went to see the gypsy, staying in a big hotel. He smiled when he saw me coming, and he said, well, well, well. His room was dark and crowded, lights were low and dim. How are you? He said to me. Back to him.
Sean Latham is the director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa and the organizer of Dylan at 80, a virtual symposium which gets underway this Saturday through Monday. Information on attending is at dylan.utulsa.edu. He's also the editor of the new book, The World of Bob Dylan, published by Cambridge University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Drive you from your fear. Bring you through the mirror. He did it in Las Vegas, and he can do it here. Outside the lights were shining on the river of tears. I watched him from the distance with the music in my ear.